You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
Welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities, an inclusive podcast focused on queer, disabled, and marginalized creatives and their art. If you can afford to help me keep the podcast going and help me get the transcription service in place, please sign up to my Patreon for as little as £1 a month on patreon.com/agparker. You can also buy me a coffee on Buy Me a Coffee, which you can find on my link tree. And now, on with the show. Today on the podcast, I've got Hannah Hutzpah, who is a performance poet and writer with three collections of poetry out, most recently Permeable, published by Burning Eye Books. Her poetry is funny, feminist, and often heartfelt. On a number of occasions, it's made people cry, apparently in a good way. Hannah studied creative writing at UEA and has been performing since 2009. She has bylines in The Guardian and The Independent and has ghostwritten copy for commercial, academic and charity audiences. Hannah is an Edinburgh Fringe regular and has also toured the UK with her one-woman shows, Asking Nicely, Confidence Tricks and Anxiety and Animal Gifts. Asking Nicely received 5-star reviews in 2014 and 2015 and was voted best feel-good spoken word show on the PBH Free Fringe. Hannah has performed everywhere from Occupy to the Tate Modern and the National Space Centre. She occasionally runs writing shops for adults or in schools, and she booked the creative writing programme for Nine Worlds Geek Fest for a couple of years. Hannah is a left-handed, left-wing smartass with intersectional activist leanings, spoons allowing. She has been described as fine by three therapists, as of good character by a High Court judge, and as a potential maggot thrower by the Met Police. Hannah, welcome to Cabinet of Curiosities.
I heard that. I was like, yeah, that is my, which version of my bio? Jesus, I'm going on. But yeah.
I love it. Wow. I mean, that's quite a number of accolades. Like, yeah.
Some weird gongs in there.
That's amazing. I love like the variety of people I get on the podcast, but I love that within one person, there is so much variety with you.
ADHD.
ADHD and creativity, it seems to, how do you, let's just fucking jump straight in. What's your view on it? Because I feel like in some respects it's fantastic, in others it's, you know, kind of really hinders us.
I think so. Basically, the way I've heard ADHD described as like having a sports car engine with like dinky, absolutely crap brakes, and it's like there's a lot of thoughts going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more rapid your thought processes are, and in some ways the more sporadic, the more unusual they are, then that's where creativity happens, right? You think about one thing, then you think about another thing, and then they sort of form into some new thing, and that's creativity. You just created a new thing by going, what about adding A to B in this unusual way? The problem is that I think we have way more ideas than your average bear, and a shitload of enthusiasm, there is also all of the executive function issues with actually following through.
Yeah.
So like every time I've moved house, it's my least favorite thing in the world. And I think a large reason is that there's a lot of, not just writing projects, but I like making shit, full stop. Like, there is fabric scraps, there is half-finished woodwork.
I know. I have
all this shit.
I've got five vintage chairs in my shed, which I'm like, God, I'm going to rebuild them.
Amazing, right?
Yeah, but what is it?
There's a lot of people who would go, oh, that looks like a lot of work. No, we have the enthusiasm to be like, yes, yes.
Yeah.
But then come the house move, it feels like a referendum on, are you ever actually going to do that? And like there is this silting up of like objects half done, and that is the gap between the enthusiasm and the ideas,
yeah,
and the actually following through / how many hours there are in the day,
and spoons.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So yeah, I think it's strange because I think everyone I know with ADHD like drives themselves bananas and feels like they're failing, and to the external world they are scatterbrained and, you know, a bit kooky or whatever, but also actually doing quite a lot of impressive things. The thing is that we have the internal monologue of, we know how many ideas we've had that we haven't managed to make. So yeah, I think it's almost worth keeping a neurotypical perspective on, like, no, actually you're smashing it.
I love that. That's actually really helpful, and I completely relate to that because I've got like maybe like 120 notes on projects that I want to do, and I definitely relate to that. You know, you've got that kind of firing of it's the spark of creativity, isn't it? You've got like all of this. I can start stuff, or I can have the ideas to start stuff, but actually mm-hmm. having the time and the energy to kind of follow it through is really, really hard. So I do mm-hmm. feel like I'm failing, but then I've got people on the outside saying like, oh my God, you're doing all these amazing things, but right. you're so right. Like, it's because we can see the thousands of things that we want to do.
Yep.
That's amazing. So how was it pre-ADHD diagnosis and trying to do what you do?
Yeah, so pre-diagnosis, I was just a bit unusual. Like, I didn't have any terms of reference for it. Actually, that's a lie. I did have terms of reference, but they were incorrect ones, right? Like, you will come up with a reason why you do blah. Like, or maybe it's self-sabotage that I keep putting this thing off when I know it's not that difficult. So like, I come up with a bunch of reasons for the procrastination, and then for the slightly unusual stuff, actually my brother's non-neurotypical, I've got one parent from another country, so I always had this kind of like, oh well, my family's a bit unusual and I'm just kind of a bit unusual from them,
yeah,
as opposed to like, in my own right I am legitimately what I don't know. Yeah. I found these like external reasons. And then when you don't, and then there's a bunch of things that you don't really have a reason for, and then you're just a bit ashamed. There's a lot of things with, so I had the weirdest journey to diagnosis. Actually, no, probably not the weirdest, but I was working for a charity, and I do communications. And for the EDI working group that had just kicked off, the Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Working Group, we were going to do some case studies like within staff of people who are happy to talk about any protected characteristic, any disabilities or
yeah,
sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. And didn't have anyone volunteering to be like, I will talk about my marriage, although that is a protected characteristic. but, you know, the standard ones that you would think of at the first glance. And there was a woman who volunteered to talk about her ADHD, and to my shame, looking back, I had a bit of a like, oh, come on. That's not right. And she described, she was in her 40s or 50s, and she'd only been diagnosed fairly recently, but she had worked with a lot of, it was a drug and alcohol charity, and she'd worked with a lot of people like in prisons, in rehab, in whatever. And she said that the reason that she thought she was drawn to that and that she could relate was that she kind of knew that, you know, but for the grace of God, she had some of those tendencies.
Yeah.
And we know that things like dyslexia are massively overrepresented in prisons because there's quite a clear pipeline between like not doing so well in school into not having great career options, into petty criminality, et cetera, et cetera. She described her experiences to me, and I went, Jesus Christ, every little quirk of mine that I didn't have a name or a frame for,
yeah,
it turned out to be in this one arc. So within about a day, I had stuck something on Facebook. A friend of mine had tracked down some WHO guidelines, and I'd been like, yep, shit, yep, wow, that, whoa. then I went to my GP, and I was very lucky that I got someone immediately who was like, okay, so it sounds like you want to be referred. Okay, cool. Well, I'll put in a referral. Didn't tell me I was too old, too female, whatever. I was really lucky with that GP. And then it was about 6 months until I saw a specialist, which at the time I was like, I know that there's a drug that can make my brain work better. I want it now. I can't believe I have to wait six whole, and yeah, it's like 2 years plus. Like, I was so lucky.
Yeah.
This was like 7 years ago, maybe. But yeah, and then it was probably like a couple of years at least of like starting to look back with like, I've gotten into trouble at different workplaces. I have sometimes poor attention to detail. If something's boring, I really can't make myself start the thing. I'm quite impulsive. I'll jump in on a conversation, and a lot of people read that as rudeness or arrogance. And it was probably at least 2 years of me kind of like bit by bit reconciling, like working out that this thing, why didn't that work? And for every single one, I would have already had a reason. I was like, yeah, well, the commute was killing me and the work was boring and my manager was an asshole.
Yeah.
That was also true, but also my brain and my difference meant that X, Y. And that was quite weird because a lot of it was stuff I was ashamed of, right? Like the reasons I'd come up with were all reasons it was someone else's fault, because I was also embarrassed at, like, yeah, no, that was a really easy piece of work and I don't know why I didn't do it for however long.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I don't know. Since then I've become a pretty noisy advocate, just like on my own social media,
whatever. Which we love.
Yeah. Like I've and weirdly, like, it feels a lot to me like coming out. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that people started coming out and then we realized that we'd all kind of grouped ourselves already. Like, I don't have many, excuse me, I'm going to use a really offensive term here, but I don't have that many plain brain friends.
Whoa, oh, I love that. I've actually never heard that before, but yeah. Do you find as well, you like things just disappear and they've completely gone and you can't kind of trace back where the fuck you could have left them?
I'm actually not too bad with objects most of the time. That is one that I'm not. And I think that's potentially, like, my mother is always like, we had a few burglaries when I was a kid and like it's just like very terrified of losing objects. So I don't know if I've had it like weirdly drilled into me.
Like an anxiety pattern.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I'm actually not too bad at that, but it's the it's like task initiation or keeping track of, like, there'll be something where if someone says, you know, we said we'd do such and such, I will remember when they tell me. But
until
if
then,
I have
doesn't...
Yeah. And like I have dented some friendships by, you know, not remembering that we had plans to do blah, and people read that as not caring.
Yeah.
And that's a really difficult one to like unpick, because like I am embarrassed, but also it's disability, but also that really sounds like an excuse because you're mad at me because I forgot that we said we go do blah and double book myself. Like, that's a lot of stuff is in this weird axis where it sounds like an excuse, but also may really, really, really.
Yeah, it's the legitimate reason. But this is why it's so important for people like you to be noisy on social media and in pretty much any space that you take up, which is fantastic. Because then other people with ADHD can go, oh my God, I do that too. That's what that is. And people without ADHD can go, oh, my friends don't hate me. That's really nice.
Yeah. 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 I hadn't actually thought of the education for the neurotypical side of it. But yeah.
What?
No, okay, I probably had, but like, yeah, the my focus has more been on like the people who are also struggling and don't have vocab for it, because that's a really tough place to be.
Yeah. I mean, I remember having a conversation with Icicle on here maybe 2 years ago, and she was telling me about her ADHD and like the process of getting diagnosed. And I was like, it's really funny because like I feel like I've got all of those things. And she's like, go and get a diagnosis. And I still haven't. I've like asked my doctor about it like a couple of times, but because I'm going through so many other specialist consultations, it's kind of like on a wait list.
Yeah.
But who I did see was an EDS, Ehlers-Danlos, like specialist who have done research into the connection between EDS and ADHD and autism.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, mate, you've got the spicy brain. Congrats. Don't bother with a diagnosis. Just fucking crack on as is, because it's such a long wait time.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, yeah, it's so tough. And I think that's presumably underfunding, and that there's this weird like backlog also of so many, because the presentation used to be, we are looking for a white schoolboy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if that schoolboy is like a racialized minority, odds are they're getting in trouble rather than, oh gosh, how can we support you?
Yeah, it's defiant behavior, isn't it? Or whatever.
Yeah. So there's so many levels of like catching up that we got to do that, you know, adults have it. Most it's a brain thing. You don't grow out of your brain.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a bunch of adults who don't necessarily like want or need it, and I get like I do occasionally have adults asking me about what I think about, oh, because my friend's kid has it and she's not sure about the medication, and I kind of feel like I'm not allowed an opinion on child medication because I came to it in my 30s. But I do wish that I'd known a lot sooner, because I think it was from like probably like GCSEs onwards, the moment I had to organize my own homework. And the homework was really important. There was just so much stress and, you know, self-flagellation built in.
Yeah.
And yeah, if I had known, even if I had just known without having any additional support,
yeah,
I think that would have made a big difference.
Yeah. And that's it. 90% of kind of going through these things is getting a diagnosis. Gives you so much, because once you've got a reason, you can start to understand and work with yourself.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's on my to-do list to get to get an actual diagnosis and maybe some meds to help my brain so that I don't hate myself so much. Yeah. But yeah, until then, it is good to know. How have you found it impacts your creative life and your work? And you say that you've never completed an Arts Council application.
Oh god, yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people don't see quite how much admin is involved in arts careers. Like, I've managed to do Edinburgh Fringe stuff because there is a clear deadline and all my friends are talking about it on social media. So I see everyone else doing their thing and that kind of like urges me along, and there's a like, but there's not that much paperwork compared to, like, I've looked at Arts Council's apps and there is so much, it's not just, oh gosh, it's really frustrating intersection, because you have all the imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah.
That everyone does probably, but also if you've got a lifetime of just try harder, you should be good at this, why can't you?
Like, you have lots of potential, why are you wasting it?
Right. Yeah. You will have so much kind of ingrained shame already before you start. And all job apps, all Arts Council apps, whatever, I'll tell us why you're great, which is trickier for people with that history, is trickier for women or people who've been socialized as female, like all of that. But then also you've got stuff like there is this unusual intersection when I've looked at like poetry and Arts Council apps. There's very few opportunities. Maybe there is the developing your creative practice one, but there's very few opportunities outside of that, which is just, you're really good at poetry, we will pay you to do some more poetry.
Yeah.
More often than not, it's, you're really great at poetry, now you need to find a reason that that's useful for a community.
Yeah.
You go teach women from disadvantaged groups, you need to go demonstrate the mental health benefits of poetry, and you need to go find someone that needs it and basically go be a tutor for them.
Yeah.
And or like collaborate with them in ways that like that is a whole other skill set. And I'm not saying I can't, but I haven't really done it yet.
Yeah.
So then you're asking me to go demonstrate that I will be amazing at this thing I've never fucking tried before.
Also, it's the time of it. So Charlotte, Lana, and myself, we're applying for Arts Council funding for Rebel Riot, because it's clearly something that people, you know, get a lot from and they enjoy it. We're two disabled poets.
Yeah.
We want to run this fucking poetry night for other disabled people, other people who can't join in person for whatever reason, being clinically vulnerable or not. And the questions we are asked are like, can you run workshops? Can you reach out to like the deaf community and deaf poets and see how that would work? Can you put together this initiative? And it's like, okay, so you want us to actually do a lot more work, which we're not really like physically capable of doing right now. And it's almost counterproductive. Like it really puts a lot of people off.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time. And it's really frustrating, because you know that straight white able-bodied dudes will navigate this so much. Yeah, sure, I can do that. I'm sure that'd be fine. Yeah, cool. Yeah, yeah.
And then deliver something really shit.
Yeah. Or like, I don't know if you've seen like female stand-ups trying their hand for the first time, but like they are always honed to within an inch of their fucking lives, versus male stand-ups trying shit for the first time at the risk of being, you know, extremely generalist and sexist.
Yeah.
But like, male stand-ups will be like, yeah, let's try these. My mates thought they were funny down the pub. Let's try this. Okay. And they won't know that they bombed even necessarily.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, like, whereas women will have tried so fucking hard to make sure that it's like, they will be punching so far above what this particular crowd in this pub needs. But that's just to feel safe, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I don't know where this is going, but you know,
it's risk and reward, isn't it? Like, the risk for certain groups of people is always going to be so much higher, and straight white men are just made of Teflon.
yeah.
Do you find that there is much kind of prejudice and sexism, etc. in the art scene?
Ooh, I don't know if I can comment on like the art scene more broadly. I think poetry is actually a really, really lovely space. Mm. When I started out, because I've been here a while, when I started out in the like late noughties, there was a bit more like white guys rapping poorly. and it's become a much more like kind of therapeutic community sharing space.
Yeah.
Where I feel like there's less and less of that kind of ego side of it, which is really lovely. And I think that's partly things like button poetry have come over from the States, and people are like, oh, yeah, shoot, I could talk about the really meaningful thing. Like, yeah, it has changed a lot in the time that I've been here. Ours more broadly, so I spent a lot of time kind of as a hanger-on to comedy things.
Yeah.
I first went to the Fringe as like this camp follower for an improv troupe. And I know that improv is like the butt of every joke on every sitcom, but when it's good, it's really, they were a good troupe. I stand by it.
I'm not judging.
But like, they had a regular night, which was kind of my into performance stuff generally. And then I saw some poets doing some cabaret bits and pieces and kind of found them and found my own crowd from that. But there was a comedy night that I went to very regularly, but it was very curated and pretty right on. And then it was the moment I started to go to more broad stand-up stuff where, like, if you come back from a poetry night and you haven't enjoyed it, or if it hasn't been great, you'll be like, I kind of felt like I read some people's diaries. Like, yeah. Those end rhymes were a bit obvious. It's fine. If you come back from a bad comedy night, you feel like you've just witnessed, you've possibly witnessed a bunch of hate speech. Like, you feel like you need to dry clean your brain.
Yeah.
So I think, and I really can't comment on like dance or theatre or, I don't know, like, yeah, there's so many different art scenes. I think cabaret is pretty right on because it's pretty queer.
Yeah.
Maybe not completely right on, but I think it's, I don't think sexism is the biggest issue it's got. Like, I can't say how it, yeah, I can't speak for all like disadvantaged groups, but yeah, I think for sexism that's pretty fine, but stand-up is still pretty macho BS.
So sticking with like the spoken word and poetry scene, which is probably more like definitely more your vibe, I've lost my train of thought.
Oh, good,
that's really fun, can someone find it? Okay, you talked a bit about how if you come back from a poetry night and it's been a bit shit, it feels like you've maybe been like listening to people reading out their diaries.
Yeah.
Is that kind of related to like the genre expectation that spoken word poets will share traumatic and vulnerable parts of themselves?
Yes, a bit, but like, it's not even necessarily, yeah, that is definitely a genre expectation at this point, and that is a bit weird,
it's
frankly
weird, right?
Yeah, like I've seen slams where, you know, it's like a poetry slam is like open mic with scorecards, like someone's gonna win, and I mean, you know, it's, the point isn't the points, the point is that everyone goes to see some poetry, and then once a year, like, someone gets raised up as the slam champion for the year, and that's quite a nice little boost that you then pass on each year. But there is a very weird thing when you're in an art scene that is like being scored, but also being very vulnerable, where someone will like do an incredible piece that is, I don't know, apolitical and not that like emphatic on the emotions one way or the other. Like, I don't know, something described beautifully, but not necessarily very huge emotional punch.
Yeah.
And then someone will do something which is not very well done, but it's like, fuck the Tories and everyone agrees.
Yeah.
And then someone else will do something which is maybe not very good, but it's clearly about something deep and traumatic to them. And you're like, am I going to say that that was a four because you wrote it badly when you just spilled your guts on the stage about something that is clearly really raw?
Yeah.
And that is a weird tension at the heart of the scene. Like, I don't want to sort of tell people how, I mean, I don't enjoy being a judge. I've done it very rarely. And I don't want to like tell people how they should or shouldn't react to stuff. But yeah. I have also been at slams where I'm like, everyone else is digging out their deepest, darkest traumas. And I don't want to play that. A, I'm not going to win. And B, I don't really want to play that game. So here's a poem about my cat. Like,
oh, it's... I love the poems about your cat, though. Like, come on, who doesn't fucking love that?
But yeah, it is a weird one. And also, like, yeah, when people are sometimes rewarding emotional punch over necessarily art form or delivery.
Yeah.
Yeah, either art form in writing or art form in delivery. Like, what am I trying to say? Like, I don't want it to be that people feel like if you're not traumatized, you can't write.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's BS. And also, like, I'm now solidly in my mid to late 30s. I am writing about gardening. I'm not going to win a slam.
You would if I was a judge. I fucking love gardening. Like, oh my god.
But like, yeah, it's. I don't want to have that calculation in my head when I'm writing, so I try and just go, you know what? Fuck it. I'm not aiming to win any slams. I'll just write what comes to me.
I think this pressure to mine your trauma is so fucking weird. And also, it's like, it's emotionally damaging, because I think if stuff comes up, write about it, that's great. But don't kind of go looking for that. It is, as you say, it's like someone will kind of like, it's like, you know, kind of do a quarter turn to the audience and be like, and then I was assaulted. And you're like, oh, everyone's going to react like, oh my God, that's, you know, really awful. But also, that's not writing necessarily, that's brilliant.
It's
almost in line with like shock tactics.
And it's also tricky because like it's not, gosh, I like all of Twice have been asked to go to Roehampton Uni for like an afternoon and tell them people about making a career as a writer, and I'm like, I don't this is a side hustle. I do not pay my rent with this. But I had someone ask me, it's always been really interesting going, because I did study creative writing at a uni, not that one, but it's been really weird going back and being like, oh shoot, I hadn't realized how much I have changed in the time since I was a student until I'm back with students and going, oh yeah, shoot, interesting. And I often get quite a few questions that are basically along the lines of, please point the way to success. And it's like, oh, babes, if only. tell me how to score well on this essay. Tell me what the criteria are. And it's like, it's not that clean cut once you get out of this system. But I did also have someone ask me, like, quite nervously, like, do you have to write? Because I want to do poetry, but, like, do you have to write about, like, the worst stuff that's happened to you?
Yeah.
And I was like, God, no. Absolutely no, you don't have to. And B, like, well, yeah, no, you don't have to, full stop. There is no pressure to do that. Yeah. Or there should not be. Please don't feel pressure to do that. Also, like, don't talk about the thing until you're ready to talk about the thing. Mm-hmm. And you might not ever want to write about the thing. That's fine. Like, don't put that pressure on talking about it. But also, like, if you're also still learning and honing your craft, I don't know if you've ever looked back on older writing of yours and cringed.
Oh god, yeah,
right. But like, I cannot imagine doing like, oh, I'm finally ready to talk, I'm gonna talk about that big thing, and then doing it in such a way that you actually then have like, you're not really able to do it justice yet, and in the future you might be embarrassed about how you wrote about
god, yeah, so much.
Like, that that just feels like a kind of a recipe for almost like psychological self-harm. So yeah. I think just absolutely don't do that.
Winning advice. That is like, it's so good that you, one, come on the podcast to say that, because I'm sure people listening will hopefully, you know, take that on board. But also that you're saying that to students as well at the start, before they can do any of that shit. So that's really good. You said like you wouldn't win if there was an Oppression Olympics poem, but you live at a lot of cross sections. You've got hidden disability, queerness, spice brain, Jewish, dual national, and then you say you come from more messed up circumstances than your posh voice would have you think. So yeah, that is a lot of intersections to keep in mind if you're doing an issues poem.
There's a tricky thing of also like how honest can I get without, like, on a stage that's fine because you can see who's in that room, right?
Yeah.
So you can do something about, I don't know, something that might piss off your aunt if she heard it, but she's not in the room. But then whether or not you like want to publish something, like then you don't have control over who sees it or if it goes out on the internet. Like,
yeah.
So yeah, I absolutely get how poetry is a kind of, what am I trying to say? There's a bunch of things that I kind of, there's a bunch more things that I could write about, but I also have this weighing up in my head of like, is that one that I, yeah, it's tricky. Like there's a lot of things that are complicated to talk about even now.
Yeah.
And also there's a lot of stuff where, like, there's a bunch of stuff that I wouldn't do in a slam, for example. Like, I've fairly recently learned the term glass child. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I think because of a post that you put on. Yes, I am.
Yeah. For listeners, a glass child is the sibling of a child with disabilities, in that, like, it's extremely, like, families with a child with severe disabilities or health needs, like, will be, well, not even severe, families of children with disabilities or additional health needs will often do a lot of work around that child's needs, but that can leave the sibling of that child in a slightly tricky situation where, like, not necessarily through anyone's fault, but like there is a lot of attention and time given to the other sibling, and so the able-bodied or non-disabled or whatever sibling can be slightly secondary.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I grew up, I was the normal one. That's another reason that ADHD managed to like escape. My brother was thrown out of mainstream education in year five, and eventually got a couple of diagnoses, Tourette's and autism spectrum now. But I was the normal one comparatively. And when someone else is at like a paid for by the council, I hasten to add, but like 5 days a week boarding school, and you spend your entire Friday night and Sundays on the motorways to drop him off or pick him up. In a way that you then can't make XYZ social thing that, you know, all your friends are doing. There's all kinds of complicated situations, but what I want to do is complain about my disabled brother. And that doesn't sound great. So there's a bunch of things that aren't, there's a bunch of things that I think spoken word kind of relies on a person being likable a little bit.
Yeah.
And there are situations that take a bit longer to explain. Mm-hmm. That I wouldn't do in a slam. If I had a 10-minute set, maybe I'd go near it. But, like, I wouldn't want to... People are uncomfortable because they don't know where to put themselves with the really complicated narratives.
Yeah.
But they're like, my brother has disabilities and he's an arsehole. And we have a really bad relationship.
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive. Like, I love that disabled people to a lot of people are, like, innocents or angelic. And it's like, no, we can be arseholes too.
Yeah, people have this narrative that the pity narrative, I think, fucks people up in so many different directions.
Yeah.
Like, it just gets in the way of seeing a human as a human.
Yeah.
But trying to counteract something that is that ingrained in society in a short thing where it is to some extent a popularity contest as well. Like,
I always find really weird because, like, when I'm in that kind of a situation, I'm not, I don't feel particularly social. I feel like tired and stressed, and my brain, and like sensory overload as well, because normally slams and like, you know, there's lights, there's noise, there's smells, there's a bunch of fucking people touching me, which I don't really like. It's a very weird place to then try and be, and I'm not saying I try to be likable, but you want people to like you, right? You don't want to be a dick.
Yeah. And like, I think that's the other weird thing about like slam especially, is like people have one because people like the thing they're saying, not necessarily that they said it really, wrote it really well or performed it really well. Or one of the lowest scores I ever got was, I had a poem which I now introduce it differently, but it was about someone who was like really flirty with me when they were in a relationship, and then when they were single we then dated for a bit, and then it went horribly wrong. But I realized from how I'd introduced it, and I now do this little bit of preamble, but someone thought that I had helped someone cheat.
Oh no.
And I got scored a 2 out of 10.
Oh my god, what the fuck.
And it was like, this is a moral judgment about me as a person, not about, this is a pretty good poem, shut up, that is not that's not about the poem, that is about what you think of me, because for what it's worth, I didn't help anyone cheat. But yeah.
your name is being cleared.
I can give written references.
It is very bizarre though. So like, I started performing poetry during the pandemic, when it was, you know, there were online slams, and I won my first online slam because I'm behind my computer screen, which is a very comfortable place to be. But it's, I feel like we shouldn't have to sell ourselves. I know that sounds really stupid, because our job is in so many ways to connect, to communicate, and to persuade. But I feel like we shouldn't have to sell ourselves. So you saying that actually your score hinges on the preamble that you give, is really stressful.
Yeah. Or like, oh gosh, yeah.
It's so like hard.
Yeah. Or on the preamble front, like, I have one poem called "Birthday Cake," which is about a bit of a language barrier and bumping into two extremely drunk guys with a huge birthday cake. when I was walking back from, like, between my office and the train station. They didn't have much English. They kept saying birthday cake, and I was the one person who was like, oh yeah, cool, thanks, happy birthday. And all my colleagues were like, what the hell's going on? And I wrote that and have been performing it since pre-Brexit.
Wow.
Post-Brexit, I have noticed that there is a bit of a... there's a bit of a like bated breath moment where people realize that I'm talking about a language barrier, and they, well, is she gonna do a racism? And I these days I introduce it with like, there is a language barrier, FYI, there is no racism, just enjoy, sit back and enjoy.
Yeah, like relax, unclench your sphincter.
But that is now a factor in how people think about it, and that is a bit of a scary thought generally, for like, what else is going to come up that might impact, not just do people enjoy this poem, but do people now think I'm an asshole?
Yeah.
Like, I have a very brief reference to snowflakes in one poem, which is long before like the alt-right got to as big as they are.
Yeah.
And now snowflake feels like a much bigger thing. Like, it was more like, you know, the Fight Club reference when I wrote it. Like, that stuff ages, and stuff changes meaning over time, and that is quite weird.
When you're... as a writer and as a performer, to have to continually assess the social context, and literally one word, even one word that you say. Wow, well, there you go. That's it's just another thing to have to do on our job.
Stressful.
It is really stressful. Like, people think that we just kind of sit and write, and then we go and kind of share what we've written, and then that's it. And they don't see the iceberg underneath the surface of all the other jobs that we have to do.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So in terms of trying to get across some of those nuanced, more complicated kind of like themes and ideas, how about mixing some genres? Are you interested in doing any of that?
Ooh, I am. I have a few times worked with, like, done some experiments with musicians. I've been approached more than once by musicians being like, I like your stuff, I want to do music for it. And every time I've seen that on stage, it's been incredible.
Yeah.
The weird thing is that that will change when I've actually tried. Like, nothing, I should tell you, like, there's one thing that's out, but that's because I recorded the poem and then the guy created a bunch of like electronic stuff under it.
Yeah.
But my recording was done and then he just added. But it's, I mean, clearly I do have some rhythms in how I speak and how I deliver things, but the moment you're adding in music, you have to think in terms of bars and rhythm and, okay, wait, at that point you pause and then you let them do the C chord and then you, and I suck at it. I really cannot consistently add the music. It's such a, yeah, I don't know.
I've doing it the other way where, like, you put, like, a track on and then you write to the track.
I have not tried that, and that is probably the way to go. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It does. It does things to your brain. It's quite exciting.
Ooh, hello. I'm gonna scribble a little note of that. Yeah. Because I absolutely love, like, mixed. I really do think that that's the way that a lot of people. What am I trying to say? I love mixed media generally, and I think adding music, adding video, like, kicks it up a gear, and also makes it way more shareable.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I keep meaning to get into filmmaking and figuring out my way around stuff because that's a way to share stuff with a much wider audience, and it looks incredible. It is frequently, like, so many of, let's start that again. every time I've seen a poetry film done really well, it fires up all kinds of ideas in my brain, and I go, oh, that looks incredible, I want to try that. But also, that is learning a whole new medium, right?
It's a whole new thing. And, like, even I love the spoken word poetry that I see on reels and stuff, but that is, I don't have that skill set.
Or also, like, theatre ones as well. This is one that I'm less planning to do just because I know it would be such a big endeavour. But my last two times I took a show to the Edinburgh Fringe, because I'm with the Free Fringe, the PBH Free Fringe, which is you get given a venue for free, you don't have to do public liability insurance, you've got the music for free as well.
That's so cool.
But also it is incredibly scrappy and everyone's expected to pitch in, and there are things like twice I came into my venue in time for my show slot and found that the I don't even know the name of it, the head of the microphone just wasn't there.
What the fuck?
Like, fuck knows what the other acts in that venue were doing with that microphone. But it was absolutely fucked twice.
Wow.
One time I was, like, right next to Edinburgh Station, and sometimes the trains would go by really noisy at certain points in time. There was, like, sound bleed from other shows, or once I was in a bar where the sound desk was behind a curtain that was in the main bar.
What?
And then me and the show were on the other side of the curtain. But I was at the evening slot where the bar started to get more and more full. So on a Friday and Saturday, there would be people right next to that sound desk and they would be fucking with my microphone.
That's wild.
I had to finish my show outside twice. So, like, the level of, I'm trying to do a whole show, right? I'm trying to create some feeling and whatever. I basically, it felt like way too much of a fight.
Yeah.
And that's not all fringe venues. Like, I don't know, like I hashtag not fringe venues. But for me personally, I want to have a bit more control. I want to know that I can have nice lights, I can have sound, I can have not stations going by and drunk punters in rugby shirts fucking with my show. I keep thinking about how much I'd like to do a more theatery one.
Yeah.
But also, that is so much more money and time and other people that I don't really know where to start. So Yeah, it's I'm at a slightly weird crossroads where I'm like, I feel like I have evolved enough that I want to play with all these new toys, and also I do not have all the new toys.
Yeah, and the money as well. If it's like, this, as you said before, this isn't a very lucrative profession.
Oh my god!
like it's really fucking not. And then the cost to put on a shirt at the Edinburgh Fringe, for instance, which is where you'd then get, you know, all the good things. Like, you could say that you've been at the Edinburgh Fringe and mm-hmm. you'll find all the lovely new fans and stuff. It's just so much money. It's not realistic. And that is on top of the hours and days and months of work and coordinating other people that you have to put into it.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I'm really bad at coordinating other people. I will way more often just try and do it myself, and then I'll be like, I could have asked two friends who know what they're doing to help me with this.
Yeah.
And my instinct is always to be like, no, I'll do it. Oh, I fucked it up. So I think asking for help is a whole other element. Like, there are probably the skills about for some things, but also, you don't want to be asking people to all do shit for free for your baby that doesn't pay. Like,
yeah, because you're all in the same boat, essentially.
Yeah.
In the poor boat. In the fighting for scrappy, shitty stages boat. Yeah.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. In terms of, like, support for the poetry scene. Mm. So you said in your wonderful podcast guest form, thank you so much for returning it so beautifully. You've said, why do almost all the opportunities stop at 25 or your first collection? I would also love to know this. So many people would love to know this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have an answer. I'm asking the question. I see how Arts Council wants to be. I think the assumption is that if you've passed 25, you're not young and vibrant anymore. If you've done your first collection, then you'll be established. But the thing is that it's such a small scene that you can have published your first collection and have 400 books under your bed.
Yeah.
Sold 12 and still be, you know. It's really tricky. I get that with maybe with things like dance or acting, that they assume that you will have started sooner.
Yeah.
But writing, like, it's about finding your voice, and some of that comes with having some life experience. And I don't mean to, like, be shitting on the young'uns at all here, but, like, I studied creative writing at uni, and I was looking at, they also have an MA, and I went to the little thing about the MA, and they said, basically, if you're an undergrad right now, piss off. go have a life and then come back to us in a few years.
Yeah.
But then, you know, a few years go by and you go, the fees have gone up again and that won't really fit with my life right now.
And when you look at, like, the, you know, some of the huge names in poetry, they came to it very late in life, you know, like, well, not very late, but like 30s, 40s, 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So why have we got this expectation that people have going to... Also, who thinks... Sorry, there's just... I don't... From my perspective, there's just not that many people that at the age of 18 are like, I'm going to be a poet, and that's going to be the only job I ever do in my life. Like, I came to writing, well, kind of circled back to writing because of disability. Mm. And I think so many other people go through these, you know, they live a life. They have one fucking life, or maybe three or four lives, before they come to writing. And I think they should be allowed to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like... Also, like, when you're, like, I literally didn't even have my name. People talk about finding your voice. I didn't even have my name when I was 25. Like, Scott Spur is a stage name. It means smart ass in Yiddish. but my government name is long-winded and no one can spell it. And I like having a bit of a work stage divide.
Yeah.
I find that quite freeing. But yeah, like, the... I think some people do turn up really young going, I'm going to make it. But then whether or not, I think that's a very regular thing, but it's whether or not they actually stick around for, I mean, a bunch of them do. But there's also, I think there's a fairly regular churn of people who turn up to the poetry world and go, wow, this is really vibrant. I love it. Yes, cool. Us too. I'm going to be the one who makes this my living And like, I don't mean to like crap on youthful enthusiasm at all. Like, that's how you get going. That's how you earn your stripes. But I think there is a degree of like, I'll be the one who makes this commercially viable. There's been loads of people trying it. and it takes a while to hone your craft to get some people turn up amazing from the jump.
Yeah. There's some incredible young poets out there, and I'm definitely not shitting on them. Like, you know, fantastic. That's really good for them. But the poets on the scene that I really admire, their poetry is part of how they're giving back to the community, or how they're connecting with the community. And it's not just, I'm going to go show off my talent. That sounds, I'm being a real dick. I'm dicking on a lot of people today, and I don't mean to.
But I think there's also, there's just a lot of conversations that, like, there's a lot of identity conversations which are vital, but, like, can get richer and deeper with age. Like, I have heard a lot of sexual assault is bad poems. I have heard a lot of bisexuals exist poems, and I don't disagree with any of them, and I don't think any of them are particularly badly written, but I have heard that genre, that topic done a lot. Whereas I think the more years you've got, the more you can go, and that reminds me of this thing, or that is like this myth that you've just got more to draw on to then connect things in ways that haven't been done before.
Yeah.
Whereas the newer you are, like, the fewer years of experience you have to draw on. And that's not to say that everyone young is bad. Like, my first little project was called Whippersnapper Press. I was all about being young and vibrant and shouty and writing that's biting. We lost the URL, and then it got taken over by a porn site.
That's kind of poetic in itself. I love that.
Then they were willing to sell it back to us for $6,000, and I was like,
okay, what the fuck?
There was one thing on it that wasn't poetry, that was called Sex, Choose Your Own Adventure Story. And it was written as a very funny thing. There were literally no opportunities to get laid, but then it turns out that Sex, Choose Your Own Adventure turned up as a genre. So then when I lost track of the URL and it expired, someone else bought it for quite a lot, being like, oh, yeah. This is where people go for the Sex, Choose Your Own Adventure stories. It's like, yeah, it's the one where you bump into Janine from Accounts at the club. Like, it's not.
I love this. Anyway,
this is a giant tangent, but
no, actually, but yeah. Hang on that. Sorry, very quickly on that point. Sex poems written by the young. And look, I am sure, like, you know, 19-year-old, whatever, is fucking great and very experienced. But I love horny poems from 40-year-olds who have had multiple relationships and lesbians. And it's just, come on, like, that is where the meat of the this is very, it's coming out very wrong, but you know what I mean? Like, those are the really sexy poems. And then, as you say, they can link them back to like previous girlfriends or historical gay events as well, and you get this wonderful blending.
Yeah, big time.
Went on a tangent there. Sorry about that, Hannah.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I feel also like, yeah. So I host a monthly night, which is mostly online these days, which is Insight Cabaret, which is an LGBTQ+ spoken word night. Spoken word plus. Like, we've had songs, we've had stand-up, we've had whatever, hence the cabaret, but primarily poetry. And it is, I inherited it from another poet, Kaz Teague, who was hosting at the time. Kaz. And they had a couple of days where they couldn't do it and asked me to come in last minute and host. And then when they moved away, they were like, and how about? So yeah, I inherited that one from them. But it is it is quite a different night in that it is not only like the cutoff isn't like your late 30s. It is a really, really nice mixed age group. And it is a really warm, friendly, lovely community space. Not that anywhere else isn't, but but that a lot of spoken word tends towards very young. And I feel quite grateful that I have gotten this. I've gotten a queer education from it. Like, there's poets who, you know, found out they were HIV positive in the 90s and write about it, like, in the early 90s. There's a friend of a friend turns out to be someone who was literally at the Stonewall riots, and we were able to book her for LGBT History Month. Like, it's incredible. Like, things that, you know, no one necessarily tells you if you're a young queer person, but that, like, all the gay bars used to have blacked out windows. And that Stonewall Inn was quite unusual, that it wasn't a back door you had to go in to get to it.
Yeah.
I've got this, like, since it's been online, it's gotten international as well. It's incredible. This is like transatlantic and beyond.
It's the same with us. So we get people from, like, literally all over. We've had people from Africa, America, like, just, it's, and the same as you, like, we get people turning up with guitars. With people singing, and it's this wonderful mix of ages as well. We've got everyone from kind of, like, you know, 17 year olds to people in their 60s.
Yeah
Beautiful.
I need to get along to one. I keep seeing Rebel Riot on Facebook, and I'm
come
definitely.
But wait, sorry,
someone was saying the other day that, like, but because things aren't, like, it used to be, if you turned up to an in-person poetry night pre-pandemic, and even probably, I think it was dying out even before the pandemic, but you used to walk away with a shitload of flyers for all the other poetry nights. And I spend way too much time on social media, but I'm quite cautious about accepting friend requests from people I haven't actually interacted with before.
Yeah.
So I've got a wait list that's really quite long. I don't want to say fuck off, because I might bump into them next week and be like, oh yeah, cool, fine. but I think it seems because it's not physical flyers anymore, actually finding out what's where and who's involved in it, and, oh wait, that's so-and-so's night, oh, I like so-and-so, let's give it a try.
Yeah.
Like, is actually, yeah, people aren't, there isn't one way to find out about stuff anymore, yeah. And therefore it's quite scattered all of a sudden.
Yeah, scattered and spammy and...
That too.
Yeah, that's why I think relying on the community and people kind of sharing stuff. You know, like, if I get recommended a night from somebody that I know and respect, I'm like, oh, okay, I'll actually check that out. It's been delightful talking about you. Can you tell our guests about things that you've got coming up and the night you run again? So if you can just do like little promo-y bits, that'd be really cool, because you are so cool.
Thank you. So I am the host of Insight Cabaret. Insight spelled INCITE, as in Insight a Riot. And you can find that on Facebook as, I think it's Insight. Wait, I'm going to check this before I say it wrong.
I'll also add it to the description of this podcast.
Amazing. Sure. Yeah. Okay. So the page is Insight Poetry on Facebook, and we are Insight Cabaret on Twitter and Instagram. And that is once a month, mostly on Zoom, and then like one or two events a year in person in London. The next one coming up is the 24th of May. But yeah, it's usually the third Wednesday of the month. And almost all of them are online. And they are a gorgeous community space. We always have a booked feature act, a headliner of queer excellence, and a open mic. Not a slam, an open mic. And I also, I'm one of three co-hosts of Dead Darlings podcast, which you can find as Dead Darlings podcast or Dead Darlings pod, where the name was too long, on all of the social medias and wherever you get your podcasts. What else do I do? I am Hannah Chutzpah. I am honestly, most of my Instagram feed is, I will find pieces of nature and arrange them into a rainbow. But if you like the sound of like poor man's Andy Goldsworthy, you can come find me, Hannah Chutzpah, on all of the social medias.
One question that I don't know if you've listened to, but you also, right, so you talked about arranging rainbows, which I love seeing you arrange rainbows, they're fantastic. You also have a page about dragons.
Oh yes,
obviously. I love this.
Yes, oh my gosh, we need to, yeah, that needs to be a thing. So this is 100% an offshoot of ADHD, and also the fact that I for various points of time was like temping and working in different parts of London for short periods of time. And I'm someone that notices, like, I always notice the jewellery people are wearing, I always notice the kind of twiddles on the buildings.
Yeah.
And I realised that dragons were actually turned up quite a lot in all kinds of different contexts.
Yeah.
So, like, Thai restaurants, cathedrals, graffiti, like any heraldry stuff. So I started a initially a Twitter account, and there's now Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and there is a website, dragonsoflondon.org.
I didn't know there's a website. That's amazing.
I really need to update the website. The social media's been updated so much more often than the website. But it is, I got about three dragons in when I realised that I had nothing to say unless I started doing my fake David Attenborough shtick. So I'm like, oh, gorgeous, we spotted a nesting couple here. Oh, it's spring. That makes sense, everybody. And we are recording the biodiversity of London's dragon populations. So if you see a dragon, snap a dragon and send it in and say where you spotted it. It is the email address is dragontwitches@gmail.com. And I literally had, oh gosh, I'm gonna look this up before I say it wrong. So having started this extremely silly Dragons of London website, I was actually approached by Green Space Information for Greater London, who have the acronym GIGL, GIGL, but I promise they're real. And they approached me to do a map of dragons for their April Fool's Day thing.
Oh, wow.
So I have had like proper like London green space researchy people approaching me.
That's amazing.
About my stupid dragon.
I love that. So on the topic of dragons, if you were a mythical creature, what would you be and why?
Oh gosh, I feel like I kind of have to say dragon at this point.
Yes!
I mean, they're extremely cool. They're extremely adaptable, right? You got like water dragons, you got flying dragons, you got I don't know what kind of dragon I'd be. I'm gonna have to think about that. But yeah, they can fly, they're magic, like shit's all over a unicorn, cool. Let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, like, they can quite happily like sit underground for quite a while as well.
yeah they've got kind of all the elements one way or another. I think it's got to be.
I mean, yeah, you're the first other dragon on this podcast, so thank you.
Really?
Yeah. Solidarity dragon. Fabulous. Cool. Hannah, have you got anything that you'd like to share with us?
A poem, you mean?
Yeah, please.
Ooh, I can do that. Okay. This one, there's going to be a bunch of beep sounds, and that is deliberately part of the poem. I might develop, like, get a buzzer or something to make the beep sound, but right now it's going to be me. This one is called Quick and Easy Label Free Beep. This recipe is one of my favourites for when someone pops over with the best of intentions and asks why I need to limit myself with all of these zany labels. I whipped this up for all kinds of occasions. Queer, disabled, ADHD, dual national, multi-faith, you name it. This has been passed down in my family for generations by people who found life that bit more difficult but didn't know why. Hope you like it. Tell us how you get on in the comments and let us know if you've given it any new twists. Don't forget to rate and subscribe. XOXO. Step 1. Melt 50 grams of beep in a saucepan. Add one finely chopped medium beep and cook gently over a medium heat for 5 minutes until softened but not browned. Step 2. Stir in 3 of the beep, 1/4 teaspoon of beep, and 2 beep leaves, then cook for 1 minute. The guesses you fill in can't help but be generic: butter, onion, straight, white, able-bodied. Step 3. Tip in 450 grams of beep and stir until it is all well and coated in the sorry I didn't see you there. Step 4. Pour in 1 litre of beep stock. Chicken stock, stock photo, stock options. Add 1/2 teaspoon of beep and bring to the boil. Stir once to release any overcompensating from the bottom of the pan. Cover with a beep and reduce the heat to a low and rueful smile. Step 5. Meanwhile, bring some It Was Just a Joke to the boil in a large, shallow pan. Add 750 grams of beep and Not Trying Hard Enough. Simmer for 4 minutes until reasonable adjustments or a performance review. Lift it out onto a beep and leave until the emotions are cool enough to handle. Step 6. Hard boil 3 beep for 8 minutes. You are allowed to bring a union representative with you for this stage if you wish. Step 7. Flake the beep, discarding any lived experience, their current partners, or any newfangled rubbish they found on the internet. normality perpetuates itself like a racist algorithm. Drain the beep, cool slightly, then peel and chop. Step 8. Uncover the beep and remove anything that doesn't sound right to you. Gently fork in the explanations you've arrived at yourself. Weird, oversensitive, lazy, naughty, stupid, attention-seeking. Cover again and return to heat until the beep has heated through. Step 9. Gently stir in almost all of the 3 tablespoons of beep and season with a little shame to taste. Serve scattered with the remaining beep and garnished with one, gosh, you can't say anything these days, cut into wedges. Step 10. Invite your guests to season with sugar or salt. Don't limit yourselves. They're all edible crystals. It's all food. Keep flattening nuance until you don't know your beep from your beep, and no one has the beep to say why the beep just doesn't quite taste right.
I adore that poem. It's so good. Thank you so much. Like the line about like, I've forgotten it. No, see, there we go. That's my brain. God damn it. What the fuck was it? Okay. But all of the lines, there's so many lines. I think I tried to remember this one line and I was like, oh my God, that's really good. And then it was something about like self-belief or like, no, that wasn't it. Anyway. And then.
Wait. Reduce any overcompensating.
That's the one. Yes. How did you know? How did you know? That's amazing. But
rang a bell.
That line of like normality perpetuates itself like a racist algorithm. So good. Thank you so much for sharing, Hannah. It's been an absolute delight to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you. This has been an absolute delight.